Chuck, I told you the other night that my preaching is in accordance with my gifts. I have the gift of discouragement. So if you feel discouraged after my speaking, it's only because I have been proficient in the exercising of my gift. It's hard to know what chapters to take. I'm trying to pick out the most discouraging chapters I can find. I've got a goodie for you this morning. It talks about dead flies. How's that? Ecclesiastes chapter 10. Again, I'm going to read it out of Ken Taylor's Living Bible, and then we'll study it out of the Authorized Version. Whatever translation you have, read carefully as I read out of the Living Bible. Ecclesiastes chapter 10, verse 1. Dead flies will cause even a bottle of perfume to stink. Yes, a small mistake can outweigh much wisdom and honor. A wise man's heart leads him to do right, and a fool's heart leads him to do evil. You can identify a fool just by the way he walks down the street. If the boss is angry with you, don't quit. A quiet spirit will quiet his bad temper. There is another evil I have seen as I have watched the world go by, a sad situation concerning kings and rulers. For I have seen foolish men given great authority and rich men not given their rightful place of dignity. I have seen servants riding while princes walk like servants. Dig a well and fall into it. Demolish an old wall and be bitten by a snake. When working in a quarry, stones will fall and crush you. There is risk in each stroke of your axe. A dull axe requires great strength. Be wise and sharpen the blade. When the horse is stolen, it is too late to lock the barn. It is pleasant to listen to wise words, but a fool's speech brings him to ruin. Since he begins with a foolish premise, his conclusion is sheer madness. A fool knows all about the future and tells everyone in detail, but who can really know what is going to happen? A fool is so upset by a little work that he has no strength for the simplest matter. Woe to the land whose king is a child and whose leaders are already drunk in the morning. Happy the land whose king is a nobleman and whose leaders work hard before they feast and drink, and then only to strengthen themselves for the tasks ahead. Laziness lets the roof leak, and soon the rafters begin to rot. A party gives laughter, and wine gives happiness, and money gives everything. Never curse the king, not even in your thoughts, nor the rich man either, for a little bird will tell them what you've said. Sounds a little bit like the book of Proverbs, doesn't it? Let's see if we can make heads or tails out of it. I'm going to turn over here now to the book of Ecclesiastes in the book I study out of. Ecclesiastes out of the book of the King James Version. Now remember we said that there are three divisions to the book. Chapters 1 through 3, a wise man's outlook. 4 to 9, a wise man's experiences, and 10 to 12, a wise man's actions. Here in chapter 10, we have the first of the last three chapters in the book, or the first chapter in the last division. A wise man's actions in interpersonal relationships. The theme of chapter 10 is interpersonal relationships. So that's what we're going to study here. Now, the certainty of death is the starting point of Ecclesiastes. It is the thesis of Ecclesiastes that the certainty of death consumes the energies of life. The certainty of death is also the beginning of wisdom. I love Socrates, who is not a believer in any sense of the word, but in his apology, And his apology, by the way, for those of you who have not taken Philosophy 101 in college, deals with his statement regarding his philosophy of life just prior to his drinking of the hemlock. Because of Socrates' teachings, he was accused of corrupting the youth of his city-state, and the court condemned him to death. And so he writes in his apology exactly how he perceives the whole thing. And this is a statement I think relates to the book of Ecclesiastes. Listen carefully to what Socrates says. I quote him, "We do not know that life is better than death. We do not know if death, which men in their fear apprehend to be the greatest evil, may not be the greatest good. I will not save my life by committing an injustice. Only a fool will fear or avoid a possible good rather than a certain evil. The difficulty is not to avoid death, but to avoid unrighteousness, for that runs faster than death." Interesting that a man outside of the revelation of God could perceive with such clarity and wisdom thoughts such as those. Now let me point out to you that if you look to people for the meeting of your needs, the basic needs of your life, you will end up in disillusionment and despair. You see, Socrates said, "I'm not going to look to the state. I'm not going to look to my friends who spoke against me at the trial. I'm not going to look horizontally. I'm going to look to justice." Now, he didn't know where justice was to be found. It was an idea, a philosophical concept that he sought to embrace for his life. But you and I, we know better. We know that justice is to be found in the God of the Scriptures. And if you look to people rather than to God for the meeting of your needs, invariably you will end up being cruel with others and live in injustice. God has so constructed our lives that He and He alone can meet our needs. I am therefore not to look to my wife, my children, my church, my government. I have to look to no source other than God for the meeting of those needs. Why? Because the Bible teaches us that people will disappoint. They will produce disillusionment. And I will react negatively, producing cruelty. Now, we touched briefly on the fact last night that the only difference between the oppressor and the oppressed is opportunity. Every individual, given an opportunity, will oppress his fellow man. Therefore, if I put my trust in fellow men, it's like leaning on a spike. It will pierce my hand. If my relationships are based on reciprocity, that is, I scratch your back if you scratch my back, I will do good to you as long as you do good to me, then I will measure my success in my relationships by what I receive from them. Success for me then will be determined on the basis to which I'm getting you to meet my needs as I perceive them. And I'm willing to give a little bit to you if you're willing to give a little bit to me, and I hope that in that giving process I end up a little bit ahead of you. That's how most people live most of life. And what happens is you end up using people rather than serving him, which is the antithesis of the biblical message. Jesus said, "It is more blessed to give than to receive. The Son of Man came not to be ministered unto, but to minister and to give." Only when we have our focus on God can we hope to live a life like that. Only if you're looking to God for the meeting of your needs can you minister to people without expecting anything in return. And let me say it to you at the outset, my friend, every relationship you have in life is to be based on your ability to give, not on your ability to receive. Whether it is your spouse, or whether it is your children, whether it is your friends, all relationships are for the purposes of ministering. You give, and you give, and you give, and you give again. You never look horizontally for the meeting of your needs. Only then will you be acting wisely. Or to put it another way, you'll never be able to act wisely if you look to your interpersonal relationships for the meeting of your needs. Now, in verses 1 through 3, unfortunately, by the way, I couldn't get this thing broken down into three parts. This has got a bucket of sections to it. Let me give them to you very briefly, and then we'll look at them one by one. Verses 1 through 3, act wisely, don't act foolishly. Verses 4 through 7, act wisely, don't react foolishly. Verses 1 through 3 deal with your actions, 4 to 7 your reactions. Verses 8 to 10, act wisely, not just sincerely. Sincerity is not enough. 11 to 15, act wisely, guard your tongue. These are five great verses dealing with the tongue. 16 to 17, act wisely, lead by serving. And then finally, 18 to 20, act wisely, maintain a proper attitude. Let's take a look at them bite by bite. Act wisely, don't act foolishly. Verse 1, dead flies caused the ointment of the apothecary to send forth a stinking savor. So doth a little folly him that is in reputation for wisdom and honor. Dead flies. This is a familiar verse. We've all read it or heard it spoken of before. That is, poisonous flies that excrete into the ointment. Destroy it. Now, this is kind of a truth that is mentioned again and again. We hear it, for example, in the statement, a rotten apple does what? Spoils the whole barrel. That's what he's saying in verse 1. Or, as Paul says it in 1 Corinthians 5, 6, a little leaven leaveneth the whole lump. The fly in the apothecary's ointment causes it to smell. Now, self-government is the most difficult of all governments in the world. This is the reason why totalitarian governments can invariably make countries like the United States look like fools. Because a country like ours must be run by consensus, and consensus is difficult to obtain. This is the reason why our Congress can deliberate for month after month after month on what to cut from the budget in order to make it balance, everybody agreeing that it ought to balance, and everybody going home not getting it balanced and not agreeing. And we become the laughingstock of the world. And not just because of our economics, but in terms of anything that we do is we try to gain a consensus for action. It's a problem that the Russians don't have. Simply because the ruling oligarchy makes a decree, and that's the way it is. Self-government, therefore, as I pointed out, is the most difficult of all governments. But this is nowhere more true than it is in the governing of one's self. The governing of your own life. There is no discipline quite as difficult as self-discipline. It is easier to live under the law than it is under grace. And that is the reason why there's just a whole bunch of Pharisaism in all of us. All of us will gravitate toward law rather than liberty simply because it is so comfortable and convenient and easily defined. This is the reason why legalistic religions of Christianity, such as the Roman Catholic Church, is so attractive to so many people. You don't have to think. There is no liberty. They tell you exactly what to do. When a man under grace, living in liberty, refuses to discipline himself, folly is the result. And when a man lives in folly, that becomes his reputation. People forget the things that made him great. Reputations are easier to destroy than they are to make. And so, the writer says in verse 1, Just like the fly causes the ointment of the apothecary to stink, so does a little folly in him that is in reputation for wisdom and honor. You see it all through the Bible. Most people forget that Solomon was a wise king. Why? Because he did some foolish things toward the end of his life. Most people think of Jacob in terms of being a cunning deceiver, Rahab as being a harlot and a deceiver and a cheat, Samson as being a man who could not control his passions. And yet the Bible calls all of these people, including Rahab the harlot, great. Easy to forget their greatness when we see their folly. Character is what you are. Reputation is what people think you are. Therefore, the Bible says, major on your character, and God will take care of your reputation. Now, people enjoy ruining other people's reputations. We find it all the time. For example, the media is really past masters at this, aren't they? And they will interview somebody and ask questions of such a nature that it makes them appear like they're fools. And then they edit it and cut it before they show it on television, and it doesn't reflect the opinion of the individual giving the interview at all. And what happens is we lose sight of his character. Interesting, we felt that way about Harry Truman, didn't we, when he was president of the United States? The press enjoyed massacring that man's reputation. Today, after his death, and we've had a chance to look at him, many are coming to the conclusion he was one of the truly great presidents that the United States has ever had. You never would have read that in the headlines of the newspapers while he was the president of the United States. It is fun to characterize a person and ruin their reputation. Verse 2, a wise man's heart is at his right hand, but a fool's heart is at his left. A wise man decides what is right and insists that his heart follows. A fool follows his heart and rationalizes his impropriety with his mind. Let me ask you, are you a wise man or a woman, or are you a fool? Do you lead with your heart, or do you lead with your head? There's a need for balance here. You've got to be wise in your evaluation and cautious in your communication. This is part of what it means to relate properly to people. In your interpersonal relationships, Solomon says, a wise man's heart is at his right hand. That is, it is governed by his mind. But a fool's heart is at its left. That is, it runs itself and the mind follows. Verses 4 through 7, act wisely, don't react foolishly. If the spirit of the ruler rise up against thee, leave not thy place, for yielding pacifieth great offenses. There is an evil which I have seen under the sun, as an error which proceedeth from the ruler. Folly is set in great dignity, and the rich sit in low place. I have seen servants upon horses, and princes walking as servants upon the earth. Sometimes, says Solomon, God puts us under the authority of rash people. People who are capricious and arbitrary in their behavior. And he cautions us that we must avoid two things. First of all, don't become the slave of authority. Observe, inquire, form opinions, but don't become enslaved by it. Secondly, don't despise authority. Don't rebel against the system. It's God-ordained. Paul says, there is no authority but of God. The authorities that be are ordained of God. Who therefore resisteth the authority resisteth God. Romans chapter 13. Now, how do you do this? How do you maintain the balance between understanding what capricious leadership looks like on the one hand and yet not being rebellious on the other. Solomon here, in this paragraph, suggests two things. Verse 4, he says, when authority is brash and unreasonable, don't resist it. Keep your mouth shut. The unwise leader will quiet down. God will fight for you. How many of you have ever memorized Exodus 14:14? Anybody know that? Good verse for your future memory list. God speaking through his servant Moses, when their backs are against the Red Sea and the Egyptian army is coming in on them, says, and I quote, "The Lord shall fight for you, and ye shall hold your peace." Don't fight. Let God fight for you. See, when you fight, it's because you think you can do a better job than God. If you think God can do a better job, then keep your mouth shut and let him fight for you. That's what Moses said, and that's what Solomon says in verse 4. And then in verses 5 through 7, he says, maintain your objectivity and observe what is happening. Notice, learn from it. The two go together. You see, it's difficult to put what is happening around you into perspective, especially when the going gets rough. It's easy to react. Wisdom, says Solomon, in your interpersonal relationships means that you see things as they are, but you respond properly rather than react improperly. I like the quote of a guy by the name of Wardlaw. I don't know who Wardlaw is, but I ran across this and I commend it to you. He said, quote, "The weak reed by bending in a rough wind receiveth no hurt when the sturdy oak is torn up by its roots." Power over one's spirit is a higher virtue than proving you are right. When the wind blows, bend. Only if God is the focus of your life can you do this. Let me remind you this morning, my friend, only the secure can be humble. Insecure people are incapable of humility. They do not have the emotional reservoir necessary to bend with the wind. Only the secure can be humble. And only if your focus is on God will you be secure. Only if you're looking to him for the meeting of your need. Only if you see him as the source of your fulfillment will you be secure. And consequently, live in humility. In verses 8 to 10, he says, act wisely, not just sincerely. Verse 8, he that diggeth a pit shall fall into it, and whosoever breaketh a hedge, a serpent shall bite him. Whoso removeth stone shall be hurt therewith, and he that cleaveth wood shall be endangered thereby. If the iron be blunt, and he do not whet the edge, then must he put more strength. But wisdom is profitable to direct. Now, these are a series of statements dealing with the earnest person who acts without thinking through the implications of his act. The guy who says, I got to get that hedge pulled down, and he gets bit in the process. The guy who says, I got to cut the wood, and he doesn't think to sharpen the axe before he begins to cut. Now, some of the most dangerous people in the world are those who are sincerely wrong. They act, they're sincere in their act, but they're wrong. The Ayatollah Khomeini is a class A illustration of that. I personally believe the man is genuinely sincere in what he's doing. Nothing more frightening than meeting a sincerely wrong individual. And Solomon here is saying in verses 8 to 10 that sincerity is no substitute for wisdom. Being sincere does not guarantee success. And there's a lot of people in business today who know what that's all about. And you can go out there in the marketplace and you can be sincere in your desire to make $1 million and just as easily lose $1 million. So Solomon warns that earnestness may cover up an evasion of thinking through in life. Notice what he says at the end of verse 10. Wisdom is profitable to direct. You see, wisdom comes from the Word of God. This is how the edge is sharpened. This is how you react properly. In verses 11 through 15, he says, act wisely, guard your tongue. Now, in these verses, you have the contrast between the tongue properly and improperly used. I need not remind you this morning that the tongue can heal, it can encourage, it can bring salvation. But just as easily, the tongue can cut, it can hurt, it can gossip, bring false witness, and be exceedingly cruel. It's capable of both. I remember as a youngster, my mom took me aside because I had a sharp, cutting tongue. And I'll never forget her rebuke. She said to me, and let me just say parenthetically, my mom is not a Christian, but a wise woman. And she said to me, son, guard your tongue and guard it well. For it causes tremendous hurt. Anger can be forgotten, but words are never forgotten. And though the apology is made, and reconciliation takes place, and all is forgotten, the people against whom you hurled those abusive sayings will resurrect those in their mind at the most improper time, and the wounds will be opened again. Guard your tongue. Yeah, Mom, right. She is right as rain. Guard that tongue. This is a tremendously important issue in interpersonal relationships. Grace is greater than intellect. And so in verse 11, we see the stinging lips. Surely the serpent will bite without enhancement or enchantment, and a babbler is no better. I like what Martin Luther said on this verse. He said, the babbler is nothing better than a serpent who stings without provocation. In verse 12, you have the consuming lips. The words of a wise man's mouth are gracious, but the lips of a fool will swallow up himself. They consume. I'm reminded of Rehoboam's lips. When the wise men came to him and said, your father Solomon dealt harshly with us. Deal kindly with us and we'll make you king. And he said, as he followed the counsel of his friends, if you think dad was bad, wait till I'm done with you. What a dumb comment. It consumed him. In verse 13, you have the wicked lips. The beginning of the words of his mouth is foolishness, and the end of his talk is mischievous madness. The tongue speaks and spreads fear, and thus people do evil. As I was meditating on this verse, I was thinking of the riot of the silversmiths in the book of Acts in Ephesus. Remember that? Paul is preaching at Ephesus. And the silversmiths said to themselves, if this guy is listened to, we're going to go out of business. And so they started a riot. That is an illustration of verse 13, the wicked lips. You see it in interpersonal relationships in the family unit, don't you? Here's a man, he comes home from the office, and Pete has done him ill. At least that's his perception. And so he's mad, he's hopping mad, he's angry. And so as he sits around the dinner table, he tells his wife and his kids what a rotten, dirty bum Pete is. And what happens to the wife and family? They become angry. They become emboldened in it. They don't understand. They just know they love their husband and their dad. And they hate Pete. And it spreads like a cancer. That's the wicked lips of verse 13. In verse 14, you have the babbling lips. Oh, I love that. A fool also is full of words. A man cannot tell what shall be and what shall be after him. Who can tell him? See, he doesn't know what he's talking about. He doesn't know what's coming. He doesn't know where he's going. All he does is talk. Have you ever met people like that? I mean, you can't even turn them off. They just on and on and on. Words too often are a substitute for thinking rather than the medium of thought. They don't know where they're going. They don't know what they're saying. They simply love to hear themselves speak. And then finally, in verse 15, you have the disoriented lips. The laborer of the foolish wearieth every one of them, because he knoweth not how to go to the city. The fool so entangles himself with his words that he doesn't even know where he's going. You run across people like this. How do you get to town? Well, you turn right at the gate, and then you go six blocks, and then you turn left, and then, no, back up three blocks, and you turn right, and then you go, and no, you back up one block from turning right, and you go left, and by the time he's done, he doesn't know where he's going, you don't know where he's going, and he's totally disoriented. I remember I had a teacher in school who said, when I was babbling one day in class, disoriented, not sure of the answer, she stopped me cold in my tracks and said, "Henriksen, time out." I stopped and she looked at me with her piercing look and she said, "Say what you mean and mean what you say. Now, if you got something to say, say it. If you don't, tell me you don't, and let's get on with the lesson." See, this guy, says Solomon, can't even get to the city. He's so disoriented in his thinking, but he insists on talking anyway. Act wisely, guard your tongue. And then in 16 and 17, he says, act wisely, lead by serving. Woe to thee, O land, when thy king is a child and thy princes eat in the morning. Blessed art thou, O land, when thy king is the son of nobles and thy princes eat in the season, for strength and not for drunkenness. In Oriental lands, you've got to understand that in Oriental lands in which Solomon was living here, breakfast was quite simple. To feast in the morning was an expression or proof of intemperance. Therefore, he says in verse 16, if you eat in the morning, that is, you're hedonistic. That is, you rule by your own desires and appetites. But if you eat in due season, that is, only for strength, it's because you are ruling according to the needs of others. Now, you can lead by virtue of your office, or you can lead by virtue of your life. If you lead by virtue of your office, you're like the king who feasts in the morning. If you lead by virtue of your life, you are like the king who leads by his life. See, the way a man lives is the way a man leads. Intemperance in one is intemperance in the other. We quoted the verse before, Mark 10:45, the Son of Man came not to be ministered unto, but to minister and to give his life a ransom for many. In all of life's relationships, interpersonal relationships, this is true, where authority is at stake. If I elect to lead my family unit by virtue of my office, then I will become capricious and my leadership will be by intimidation. Why are we going to do this, Dad? Because I said so. Shut up. And now what happens is either my kids rebel against me or they're crushed and become unmotivated. You see, there is an inspired leadership that causes others to strive for excellence. This is the leadership of the servant. That's the reason why we're all so eager to follow Jesus. Why? Because he was the servant leader. We all want to emulate him. We all want to follow him. Why? Because he showed us a quality of excellence through the way he led. 18 to 20. Act wisely. Maintain a proper attitude. Verse 18. By much slothfulness, the building decayeth, and through idleness of the hands, the house droppeth through. This is a problem that all of us have in life. It's a problem of balance, a problem of temperance. He uses the illustration of a building. Let's take your home for an example. Now, if your home is like my home, and I know that it is, your home is nothing but a piece of rotting, decaying wood and stubble. It's constantly in a state of disrepair. I don't know about you, but I know that in my house, I could spend 168 hours a week on it and never be done. There's always stuff to do. Why? Because things are constantly in the process of breaking down. There are always lawns to mow, weeds to pull, shutters to paint, carpet to clean, on and on and on. There's dust is constant. It's always in the state of disrepair. So I say to myself, do I want to spend 168 hours a week cleaning my house? And I say to myself, categorically, no. It's nothing but a piece of decaying rot. Then what do? Do I leave it and to decay and to rot? No, I can't do that. That's what Solomon is talking about here in verse 18. If I did that, I'd have no place to live very quickly. Also, I'd be a lousy testimony to my neighbors who I'm trying to reach with the gospel of Jesus Christ. So then I ask myself the next question. How much time should I spend on my house? I can't spend all of my time, but I do have to spend some of my time. Now, as I try to get the two together, how much is enough? And you know the answer to that? I don't. I haven't the faintest idea what the answer to that is. How much is enough? Have you got it figured out? There's balance in there, but I don't know where the balance is. Strive for excellence is what he says in verse 18, but you can't give your soul to it. The tempter who suggests delaying what is right is ready to suggest an excuse for tomorrow as well as today. If my roof needs repair, I got to go fix it. I can't procrastinate and put it off. It's not going to get any better with neglect. It's only going to get worse. And so I've got to take care of it. But as I take care of it, I've got to understand that I'm taking care of trivia. We learn to do evil by doing nothing. In the parable of the talents, in Luke chapter 19, verse 20, the man that Jesus condemns is the one who elected to do nothing. Everybody else was blessed. Don't give your life to it, but, says Solomon, do something. You've got to strive for excellence. In verse 19, he talks about not misusing your resources. A feast is made for laughter, and wine maketh merry, but money answereth all things. Money. The person who has it wants nothing this world can give. But this world can't give the things you want the most. Three things everybody wants. Health, happiness, immortality. And money cannot help you in any of the three. These are the three most important possessions an individual has. Now, the Bible says there are two things about money you've got to remember. Number one is, its source is God. Number two, its use is people. Now, when the source and the use are combined, you can find happiness. But if you separate the source from the use, you end up in unhappiness. The interesting thing about life is, the more you have, the harder it is to combine the two. The new Christian, who's making $10,000 a year, has an easier time giving 10% or 20% of his money to the Lord than the individual who's making $100,000 a year. The more you make, the harder it is to be generous. Have you ever noticed that about yourself? in terms of percent of your income. I'm not talking about in terms of the amount you give. I'm talking about in terms of the percent of your income. The more you make, the less you're likely to give. For a guy making $10,000 a year, to give $1,000 sounds reasonable. For a guy making $1 million a year, to give $100,000, that sticks right in his throat. But the truth of the matter is, with $900,000 left to spend on himself, he could easily give that $100,000 and still more. If you remember that the source is God and the use is people, you'll be all right. But let me caution you, the more money you make, the harder it'll be to keep those two together. And then finally, in verse 20, he says, control your thought life. Curse not the king, do not in thy thought, and curse not the rich man in thy bedchamber. For a bird of the air shall carry the voice, and that which hath wings shall tell the matter. I love that verse. Now, he's not talking here in this verse about evaluation. He's talking in this verse about retaliation. The two are different. Evaluate, he said earlier in the chapter. He says, but don't retaliate. Let me remind you, my friend, Solomon here says in verse 20, you can think nothing without that thought having its consequences. There's a little ditty we all learned when we came around the navigators. Sow a thought and reap a act. Sow an act and reap a habit. Sow a habit and reap an eternity. A character. Sow a character and reap an eternity. Destiny. Sow a destiny and reap a... I'll get it right and I'll review it tomorrow night. That's what Solomon is saying here. You can't think a thought without it having a consequence. Remember, retribution is punishment for wrong. Retaliation is getting even. Retribution is the basis of life. God, however, prohibits retaliation. Even in your mind. Evaluate. But don't go through the mental gymnastics of retaliating. You ever do that? I said to him, he said to me, I said to him, he said to me. You get heated inside. Nobody's listening but you and God. Huh? You ever do that? You madder you get, and then you come up with a real handy I said to him, and you think to yourself, boy, why didn't I think of that when I was talking to him? Man, that would have got him good. And you get so embroiled. You ever do that? Exercised inside of your own spirit. Psalm says, don't do it. It's got its consequences. A little bird's going to let it out. You may not think so. You may think your thought life is private. But every thought has a consequence. Act wisely. Maintain a proper attitude. Well, really, what Solomon is talking about here is what the Lord Jesus said in the Gospels. If you seek to save your life, you'll lose it. But if you lose your life for my sake and the gospel's, you're going to find it. If you save your life, if you try to save it, my friend, you'll use people rather than help them. You'll lose your perspective and be unable to evaluate and relate to events that come into your life. You'll misuse your resources. You'll misuse your tongue. You'll misuse your relationships with other people. You'll fall out of sorts with God. If, however, you're willing to lose your life... then you'll consider everything, including all of your resources, expendable for the sake of meeting the needs of other people. Your character will be marked by justice and righteousness, and you'll take on the hue and fragrance of the Lord Jesus Christ. In short, you'll end up finding your life. Act wisely, says Solomon, in all of your interpersonal relationships. Amen?